Session number 9211, Aerial 2.
Squadron Leader Curtis, Real 2. I think you were explaining about how you learned how to fly.
Oh, yes. The pilots that I flew with were, I felt, were very far-seeing, inasmuch as they seemed to realise that in the event of their getting hit or wounded or whatever, it was logical that or sensible that that another member of air crew could or should fly the aircraft, at least straight and level, in order that one could get back home. Naturally, I was very keen on this. I think that maybe everyone really wanted to be a pilot in their heart of hearts. And I got as much Ling Trainer practice in as I possibly could. Probably got more Ling Trainer hours as a wireless operator than probably anybody else in the Air Force. But I enjoyed flying aircraft. Most of the flying I did, frankly, was on this bombing development unit.
I would like to ask you a bit more about the bombing development unit. What was the function of this particular outfit?
That's a very good question, because it all seemed to me to be rather hush-hush, and there were there was a wide range of aircraft used on this unit, even including, as I remember, an American dive bomber. Can't remember the name. Can't remember what it was called. I can only presume that the command itself was always striving to improve bombing techniques, with probably newer and better bomb sites. Frankly, we were told very little about it.
What did your duties consist of then when you were there?
Basically, just being a member of air crew, I presume that it was laid down that each aircraft had to have a wireless operator on board. That's the only reason I can think of.
Presumably, if you didn't fly with a full air crew, you would alter the trim of the aircraft and that might disturb the tests.
That's more than likely.
Besides bomb sites, did they test any other sorts of equipment? Did they test radios, for example, or anything like that?
No, I'm sure that... I don't remember that at all. I'm sure that I would have been brought into that if it had been.
While you were at this bombing development unit, were you part of a crew that you'd been in before, or had you been taken and posted into it as an individual?
No, I'd been taken and posted into it as an individual. When I was initially posted there, I thought it was because of my experience flying with bomber squadrons, but it didn't appear to work out that way at all. As far as I can remember, I was just a member of a crew. I flew with many different crews and pilots, and I know there were one or two boffins, civilian people, floating around at the same time, and... But here again, they kept themselves very much to themselves. So I can only presume that it was rather hush-hush equipment that they were testing.
I think from there you went on to 617 Squadron.
That's right. I heard on the grapevine that a special squadron was being formed. And as quite frankly, I found the activity on this bombing development unit rather tame after being on the squadron for such a lot, because I'd operated every year since 1940, and frankly wanted to get back in the honor squadron again.
How did you get into it then? Was it difficult getting into 617?
Well, I was told when I'd made application that the requirements were to get on this squadron. That you had to have done at least two tours of operations, which I had. I'd done approximately 2.5 tours by this time. And I was surprised when I joined the squadron to find that such a lot of the aircrew had done comparatively few operational sorties. I was very surprised at that. I know that when I came before Guy Gibson, the interesting thing that he asked me, from my point of view, was the fact that he said, "I see you haven't got any decorations." And I said, "No." He said, "Well, that's surprising." And the next thing I knew, that the day after I joined the squadron, I was operating. This surprised me a little, I must confess.
There's no pre-operational training?
No. No, I think, I presume that that they felt what I'd had. I had a lot of experience, really. And I knew my way around pretty well.
How did the atmosphere in 617 compare with that of your previous operational squadrons?
Entirely different. There was a supreme air of confidence, a supreme air of confidence in the squadron commander. The feeling was quite incredible. I'd never come across it before in any of the other squadrons in which I'd flown. I don't know what it is, but it was just different somehow. I say this air of confidence was quite infectious, and I know that with all the pilots that I flew with, and I must have flown with at least 10 different pilots on the squadron after my Mickey Martin was posted, it was always the same, this air of confidence. I don't know why, but it was most unusual.
And you got no way of accounting for it?
No way at all. It's quite remarkable. The spirit still exists to this day. When we got together, you still have that same feeling of absolute confidence.
What was this first operation you went on?
It was one of these trips to Italy. Can't remember which one it was, where we didn't come back after doing the raid, but flew straight on to a place called Blida, near Algiers in North Africa. That was interesting too. This is the beauty of this squadron. There's always something interesting going on, something new, and some challenges all the way, which was good.
I'd like to ask you a bit about some of the people you worked with in the squadron, what they were like. What sort of impression did Gibson make on you?
Very good impression. I know that some people said he was a bit hard, but I was very, very impressed. I got on very well with him. No problems there. I only regret that I never had a chance to fly with him. I think he must have been a wonderful pilot. I was fairly close to his crew because at Scampton I shared a room with his rear gunner, who fortunately was killed on the Dortmund-Ems Canal when Squadron Leader Holden took over his crew. I was flying with Mick Martin at that time. But I was very impressed with him. You couldn't help to be. A tremendous record that the man had. But I found him likeable. hard, but very just. Couldn't really ask for anything more than that.
In what way was he hard?
If he said, do something, you did it.
Did he have a hard manner? As well as a strong will?
Yes, I think you could say that. I think he was a real professional airman.
Did he ever consult his juniors when he was making a decision, or did he always make a decision entirely on his own?
Well, frankly, I can't answer that, because I was not in that position. That would be his flight commanders who he would talk to. It's something I've never asked any of the old original people that I flew with. I've never asked them that. It's never come up before. But I should imagine that he did.
What was your rank when you joined 617? You'd been commissioned, hadn't you, by that stage?
Yes, I was flying officer when I joined 617. And strangely enough, the wireless operator that I replaced in Mick Martin's crew was a New Zealander that I'd actually trained when he'd gone through OTU. The first raid that I ever did with 617 Squadron was with Joe McCarthy, an American that we had with us.
What was Gibson like when he was in the mess on social occasions?
Oh, one of the boys. Absolutely, one of the boys. I mean, when it was time for business, he was very businesslike. And when it was time to relax, he relaxed with the best of them.
How did his style compare with that of Cheshire?
Ah, entirely different. Entirely different. Leonard Cheshire was a different type altogether. Very quiet, very relaxed, but at the same time, you did what you were told. He just approached it in a different way. But here again, a man that you were very glad to be serving under and flying with, as I did on one or two occasions with him, when presumably his own member of crew was ill or not available. Very impressive man.
And what about Tate? It's been said that Tate was rather shy.
Yes, that's right. Willie was and still is a very shy person. But a man, once he got in the air, was very much a pro. I remember talking to him after the war and saying, you know, Willie, don't you sometimes regret the war being over? It seems a terrible thing to say. And he said, I think that's possibly right. We just ran out of a war. But I, as a person, could never get close to Willie Tate. The others I could, but not Willie for some reason. It may be because he is a very, very shy person.
Did anybody get close to Willie Tate, do you think?
I really don't think so. I've spoken to a couple of members of his crew, particularly his bomb aimer, Danny Daniels, and he wasn't very forthcoming about Willie. No, of the squadron commanders that I served under, he was the most difficult to get to.
When you arrived, was there a period in which you felt that you were a new boy, or were you absorbed into 617 immediately?
No, I seemed to be absorbed immediately. No problem at all. As soon as I arrived, I felt at home. And as I said before, this spirit of confidence was very infectious. It's quite amazing. Never found it, as I said before, on any other bomber squadron.
What was Martin like to work for?
No trouble at all. We seemed to hit it off straight away. And it gives you some idea of the esteem in which I hold him, because I named one of my sons after him. The best pilot that, without doubt, that I ever flew with. One that inspired confidence. And, for that matter, so did the rest of the crew. Wonderful crew.
What were the characteristics of a good pilot, then?
That's very difficult to answer. For instance, I've seen and been with Mick Martin and Dave Shannon, where they've thrown these aircraft around like toys. They've landed in the most terrible weather conditions. They were just good pilots. I can't do any better than that.
Do you subscribe to the view that good pilots are born rather than trained?
I think there's a lot in that. I think that some pilots are naturals. I really do. I think they're just natural flyers. And the three with whom I flew most of all, which was Mick Martin, Joe McCarthy and Dave Shannon, all fitted in that category. You always felt very confident flying with them. And I hope they felt confident when I was flying with them too.
Did these good pilots all have a similar sort of temperament and outlook, or were they divergent personalities?
Oh, they were all different. Although, in the air, all exactly the same. They suddenly went from being amateurs on the ground to professionals in the air. I think that's the best way I can put it. Say this again, this feeling of confidence that came, I never worried about when I was flying with those people. Never.
And you seem to have shifted around quite a bit from one air crew to another while you were on the squadron.
Yes, this was only because of the fact that when Mick Martin was posted, and it seemed the natural thing for me to go with the people that I'd been around with before, to go into their crews. It just so happens that I think that certain people tours had expired and they were posted, and I just fitted in. At this time, of course, I was signals leader of the squadron, and I could pretty well, if there was a vacancy, I could just pretty well put myself into fly with anyone that who had a vacancy, who had a wireless operator away or posted or something like that. I can't remember the progression from Mick Martin to Dave Shannon to Joe McCarthy. And after Joe McCarthy and Dave Shannon left, as well as Mick Martin, it seemed the natural thing for me to do, just to go on flying and put myself down to fly with other people. Times that I flew with Leonard Cheshire, I think it was just a question that his own member of air crew was away or something like that.
So in effect you were acting as a reserve, weren't you?
Oh yes, I would put that, I'd say that's exactly what I was doing. After the three things, because after flying with Mick Martin and then Dave Shannon and then Joe McCarthy, all of whom I became a permanent member of those three crews until they were posted. From then on, I was flying with anyone that had a spare seat. This seemed to happen an awful lot with 617 Squadron. I think that all sorts of people did all sorts of odd jobs. I know that in the end I was going there as a semi-official photographer on daylight raid, which is crazy, really, when you think about it. But I did about 10 or 12, in brackets, unofficial trips with the squadron. But people, it was like that. You wanted to keep going and keep hammering away for some reason with 617.
Now, this would seem to be a contrast to other squadrons where I have the impression that air crews stayed together and were very stable, and there weren't many people who were acting as reserves or floating voters joining crews ad hoc as required.
I think basically that on 617 you did have a crew. Don't forget that I flew, apart from the first trip with Joe MacArthur, I flew with Mick Martin on all the raids that he did. And then when he was posted, from then on I flew as a regular member with Dave Shannon, and then with Joe MacArthur all the other way around. So there it was permanent. But there did seem to be an awful lot of odd bods floating around the squadron. And at one time we seemed to have about a dozen spare bomb aimers for some reason. I can't imagine why. But one did tend to muck in, as it were, with, dare I use the word, volunteer to fly in a position not really your own. I remember I went doing map reading on some of these daylight raids. Anything to keep flying. It was like that on other squadrons. It just didn't happen. But
it sounds as though in 617 there was a focus of loyalty to the squadron as a whole rather than to an individual crew or any other subunit.
I think that's right. I say to this day the same thing still applies. When the spirit is still there, we have a very good squadron association, and we have contact with squadron members all over the world.
You mentioned that you were squadron signals leader.
Yes.
What did you have to do in that role?
Well, you must realise that in these early days of the squadron, certain crews were used to do low-level marking of individual targets. It wasn't like mass bombing on a normal squadron. You had an individual, a small target usually to pick out, be it an engine works, an explosives works, some sort of large factory. And the most experienced crews, which were generally Martin Shannon and McCarthy, were used as low-level markers to mark these small targets for the rest of the squadron who were up there at about 18,000-20,000 feet. Control of operations to a certain extent was done by WT communication from the aircraft in which the signals leader was flying to give information as to targets or whatever to the rest of the squadron who were up there at about 20,000 feet, ready to hit the target once it was bombed. Obviously, one had to tell them, give us a chance to get away from the thing before they started bombing the targets. It was quite efficient. And I know that Leonard Cheshire did compliment the signals leaders, signals section on various occasions as to the efficiency of the section, which of course made me very proud, to say the least.
When you were doing such work, in other words, you would effectively be controlling the bombing, wouldn't you?
In a way.
Did you broadcast in clear, or did you have a voice code of some sort?
No, one used WT for this, strangely enough. And radio silence in those conditions was broken anyway. After all, they knew where we were, they knew what we were doing, and it didn't seem to make any difference at all.
But would you actually speak to them in clear language, or did you have a code of your own?
We had code. A code. We only really used plain language in times of emergency or things like that.
So, if I can get this right, you would be in the aircraft that was doing the marking.
Yes.
And that aircraft, having done its job and marked the target, you would then be asked to call up the rest of the squadron to come in and bomb.
That's right.
Were the aircraft called in by individual names and numbers, or were they called in by flights, or did you just say, right, it's okay, now for you to get on with it?
No, they were called in by individual, as I remember, they were called in by individual letters. You know, you sent out a call, and these individual aircraft answered. And when all had answered, then it was time for battle to commence.
And your sequence of calls would give them the sequence in which they were going to bomb?
That's right.
And what would your aircraft do then, once you had dropped the markers and called them up? Would you then, presumably, you'd clear the immediate target area?
Clear the immediate target area, but often used to stooge around in a way, I suppose, as master bomber. Because then, basically, RT took over for the actual controlling of the raid.
So, in effect, you were virtually operating in the same way as a forward observation officer would for an artillery battery, weren't you?
Very similar. Very similar. That's right, very similar.
Did you have other functions besides that one? Were you responsible for training or for improvements in?
Yes, we had a training system where radio operators had to practice the techniques of what they were supposed to do when raids were carried out. We had a section set up where this could be practiced, at least, as I remember, at least once a week. Because although one never lost the ability to send messages, obviously, you never forget the Morse code, practice made perfect, and it kept people on their toes.